by discussing the inflation and discussing which type of matter actually can drive that inflation. And the simplest possible choice there was the inflaton, which was just the scalar field with the standard potential, which is, however, now sort of disfavored experimentally. But nonetheless, it's like a very nice model. And then you have to make the potential a little bit more complicated to actually make this work. So anyway, so what I would like to do in the rest of the course is actually start discussing fluctuations. And we start today again learning a little bit more details about the CMB power spectrum. So CMB power spectrum. And actually, the CMB, that's the very nice graph of the power spectrum, is a result of very many effects. And so basically, there are three different sources of anisotropies. So one source, which we'll discuss a little bit more in detail in the following lectures, will be primordial quantum fluctuations. And so to do this, we will have to develop the basic techniques of QFT in curved spacetime, which I'll do basically, you know, in very, very simple terms. And I'll, most of the time, I will just deal with the quantum mechanics, with time-dependent Hamiltonian, and then show you how that transfers to quantum field theory. And so we'll infer from there this thing. And then we talked about a little bit about plasma oscillations. So plasma acoustic oscillations. But in addition to these two sources, there's actually many other sources which happened after the CMB was released. So this is called secondary anisotropies. So these would be called, if you want, primary, because they happen at the time the CMB is released or before. And these are secondary, so after the photons roam free, actually they can still be subject to some disturbances and some other effects. And these are called secondary anisotropies. And so after CMB released, and they are in some sense very dirty effects because, you know, the plasma in galaxies come into play, gravitational potentials of galaxies come into play, and so on. So actually, to model this, really you need to know the distribution of galaxies, and you need to know the composition of galaxies. And in some sense, it's dirty physics. But anyway, these are effects like integrated Sachs Wolf effect. Zeldovich effect, gravitational lensing, Doppler effect, and so on. Zeldovich. And you will discuss these in your exploration course in cosmology, so I'm not going to do it at all. But anyway, so they are basically really, really dirty physics, right? So you have to really know, for example, how many electrons are in the galaxy, and so how they polarize your photons which are coming through that galaxy and so on. Okay, so now what we did in the past is that we said we want to, when we are observing CMB, observe CMB has basically uniform temperature, which is something like 2.7 Kelvin, but there are these tiny fluctuations, and so you can write the temperature as a function of the unit vector on the sky, if you want. T is a function of n. And then you are interested in these fluctuations in the temperature, which was like T minus T0 over T0, where T0 is 2.7 Kelvin. And you can obtain it as well as an integral over the whole sky of t of n. Okay, and this is 2.7 Kelvin. And then we expanded these fluctuations, which are of the order 10 to minus 5. We expanded them in spherical harmonics. So what you do is that you just write this guy as an expansion over L, an expansion over M, minus L to L, 0 to infinity, ALM, which are the coefficients of the expansion, and my basis thing, which is the spherical harmonics. Okay. So now, once you have that, you can plot a power spectrum, which is basically these ALM squares, and you sum over M. So if you think about ALM as a vector in the M space, so for a fixed L, I have 2L plus 1 dimensional thing. And so the magnitude of that is ALM square, and then sum over M. And that's what is observed. So the power spectrum CL, and this is what is observed, is defined by the magnitude of that vector, which is 2L plus 1, and it depends on L. And then sum over M is minus L to L, ALM square. Okay, and so you can, so basically by summing over M and by taking the magnitude of that vector, you eliminate any dependence on the rotation. So basically, if you rotate the thing, so that this is already rotationally invariant. Rotationally invariant. So for a given distribution of temperatures, you construct this quantity and then you plot it, and it contains lots of information. Okay, so now what we would like to do is, so this is what is observed, and now you would like to compare this to some theoretical prediction. Okay, so basically what you have to do is that you have to have some theory where the CLs actually come from, and really something which would compare this observed quantity to something which comes out from your theory. And so to do that, so we want to theoretically predict this. But to do that, you also have to realize that there is basically some kind of statistics coming in. And the problem is that the universe happens only once. So you basically have a statistical ensemble consisting only of one measurement, which is this t of n. And so you cannot really, you know, repeat the measurement, even in principle, because you would have a different universe. So in some sense, this is the only example where you cannot repeat the measurement. In all other sciences, probably, in all other experiments, you can repeat the measurement. You can always prepare your ensemble in the same state as it was before, but not here, right? So here we are really, what you want to do is you want to do a statistics on one ensemble. Okay, so to construct this CL theoretical, nevertheless, you assume that you have an ensemble of possible universes. Okay, and then you pick up one of them randomly out, and then you make some prediction and then compare with this CL observed. Okay, so we want to theoretically predict CL. So we consider an ensemble of possible universes. And so if I take that ensemble and I randomly choose one of these universes, I pick up some ALMs, okay? So we measure randomly chosen set of these ALMs. And so some ALMs will be preferred to other ALMs. So for that, you also introduce a distribution function. Okay, so we measure randomly chosen ALM with probability, probability P, which depends on this ALM. So some of them are more preferred, some of them are less preferred, and that's given by this probability distribution P. Okay. And then you are interested in various correlation functions in, you know, with respect to this probability distribution. So then, correlation function
that could be a wrong hypothesis, right?
What is wrong?
No, I mean, could be that there's a probability distribution that some universes are more likely to happen than maybe there are.
Well, that's fine. So that's captured by the probability distribution, right? I'm not saying that this is equal probability distribution.
But not if they all happen.
Sorry, not if?
Not if they all happen.
If they all happen,
then there's no sense of defining a probability. Like if they are actually all happen.
Well, then you can think about it's like really choosing the one universe we live in out of these all happening ones, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So then you can calculate the correlation function. If this is true, then you can calculate the correlation function, which is something like a probability average. And it's, of course, defined with respect to this probability P. So you have ALM, and then you have another AL prime, M prime, and so on. And you can go as many as you want. And then this will be given by the integral, and the measure is just a product of ALMs, DALMs. And then the probability and then of course what is inside your correlator. So it's A L M, A L prime, M prime, and so on. You just insert inside your probability thing. Okay. And so if this is true, then it would be nice to predict what this probability distribution actually is from some fundamental physics. And if you, once you predict what this probability distribution is, then you can calculate all these correlation functions. And so very nice probability distribution, from, for example, follows from the theory of inflation. Okay, so I'll show that, well, not really, but you just have to believe me that's true. I'll show something, okay? So, P is given by, you know, your theory, by your theory. So now, what seems to be the case, if you look at the actual CL observed, and that is basically no, some of it is like an assumption, and some of it is really confirmed by observation. So now, what turns out to be that this P is basically rotational invariant. There's no reason why it wouldn't be rotational invariant. And it's also Gaussian. And that's an assumption. So what I mean by Gaussian is that really the correlation functions satisfy the Wick's theorem. So we have seen in statistical physics that Wick's theorem is something which is very, very general and sort of comes out of the fact that you have Gaussian fields. Whatever. So now we take it as a definition of Gaussian. So Gaussian means that correlation functions obey Wick's theorem. So in particular, if you have A and then A and there is odd number of them, what is this equal to? One?
Zero.
Zero. Okay. And then if you have, so just if you have one ALM, of course it's zero, but if you have odd number of them, and if you have even number of them, then you can split it into contractions of 2 and 2 and 2 and 2. Okay, so for example, A1 to A4 is just A1, A2, A3, A4, and then three other terms. A1, A3, A2, A4, A4, and then A1, A4, A2, A3. Hopefully this is correct. So that's an example. So what I'm saying is that the Gaussian means this. And now it's an assumption that your probability distribution should be Gaussian. Of course, that's an assumption which can be tested. And so far it seems that actually it is Gaussian. Okay, so for some reason. So people study non-Gaussianities. And so there are predictions. What would happen is if really I couldn't decompose it into these two contractions of two things always. And there are predictions which you can do. And you will have very heavy calculation in your exploration course where this is actually a calculated prediction. If it were not Gaussian, what would be the prediction for some scalar correlators or for some tensor correlators and stuff like that. Interestingly, the first person who calculated this wasn't a cosmologist, but was Maldacena. Okay, so it's very embarrassing for cosmologists that actually it was a particle physicist or high energy physicist who actually calculated first this thing here. So non-Gaussianity is a possibility, which, however, is not confirmed by any experiment so far. It was done by Maldacena, and that's 02106-03, so 2002. Okay, and so you will actually reproduce that calculation in your exploration course, and that will take you something like 7 lectures. Okay, unless this is really shortened with respect to last year's, but yeah. Anyway, okay. Of course, in Maldacena's approach, it's written all very nicely, and it's like 30 pages paper, right? So it's not, but there's lots of background and lots of steps which he is actually skipping over and so on. So it's beautiful paper, you can read it. But anyway, so what we will assume here, that the distribution is actually Gaussian and it's consistent with the experiment. Okay, so then if this is true, then we definitely have that delta Pm is just one ALM is of course zero. And then if you have two of them, delta Tm and delta Tm prime, okay, so if this is rotationally invariant, then it must be just a function of the angle in between the two things. So it must be a function of, if you want, cosine of theta between n and n prime. Okay, so this is some function of n and n prime. And because it's a function of just this angle, you can make an expansion in Legendre polynomials, which of course is a special expansion in spherical spherical function polynomials. So anyway, so this is written as sum over L, 2L plus 1 divided by 4 pi, and then CL, and then this is the Legendre polynomial. Okay. So you can expand any function which is just function of this as an expansion in Legendre polynomials. And of course, these are my coefficients of the expansion. Okay, so now I have introduced another CL, which obviously has to depend only on L. And you would like to connect this CL with the CL observe, which is given over there. Okay, and so what you have to do is that you take this delta Tn, and you have formula for that, and it's given by ALM YLM. Okay, so you put it there. Of course, YLM is just some known function. So the correlator only deals with this ALMs, right? So you have correlator of ALMs. So then you have basically the correlator of two ALMs here on the left-hand side. And then you can expand your Legendre polynomials in the basis of spherical functions. And that's something like, so this guy here is something like sum over m, YLM, YLM. One of them is of n, and the other one is of n prime. Okay, and then you compare whatever you see on the left-hand side is whatever you see on the right-hand side. And so what you conclude from here is that this is true. ILM A star L prime M prime is given by delta L prime delta M M prime, and then the CL which we introduced. So in some sense, your coefficient of expansion CL here really gives you the two-point function of these ALMs. Okay, so if I know CL, I know all these two-point functions. But because my distribution is Gaussian, then I know all the functions. Yes?
What do you mean by delta L prime?
Del L, what do you mean? It's ALM, AL prime, M prime.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that simply comes by comparing the left-hand side with the right-hand side. I didn't write it, you know. Yeah, but obviously left-hand side will depend on L and L prime. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, it's just that. Okay, so now this is your CL, and if you want, that's a theoretical. And so, of course, the question is how it is related to this observational one. Okay, and so for that, you just have to calculate what is the average value of this observational one. So first, so for what is the relation between CL and CL observational? So that's the question. And the first thing you can do is calculate the average. So you calculate the average of CL observational. Okay. So by definition, it's just the average over that. So this is 1 over TL plus 1. And then the average over M. And then ALM, ALM star. Okay, but by the definition, the average over ALM, and okay, so I take the sum out, of course, and then ALM, ALM star is given here. So it's just delta LL, delta MM, and then CL. But you have sums, okay, so this is just basically CL. But you have sum of CL for M going from minus L to plus L. So there's 2L plus 1 of them. So this is just given by CL. Everybody happy with this? So just plugging here, listing here. And so you are getting really that average of observation will be given by this theoretical CL. Okay, so that was simple calculation. Of course, people are also interested in the mistake. So basically, what happens if you take the different square? And so that's called cosmic variance. now you take CL minus CL observe divided by CL, the whole thing square, and an average over that. So now this is a painful calculation. We have to actually square the things. So this is an average from 1 minus 2 CL observed divided by CL, and then plus CL observed square over CL square average here. Okay. So average of 1 is 1. Average of CL observed, we just stop. So CL without this, you know, superscript observe is just a number, right? Which determines my correlation factor. Okay, so CL observed is something which has ALMs in it, and something which actually is subject to my average. But we know that the average of CL observed is just CL. So the second term gives me minus 2 CL over CL, so minus 2. And then I still have this average here, CL observed square, CL square average here. And if you want, you can take the CL square outside. Okay, so this is minus 1, and then plus 1 over CL square, and then average. And then you have to write down everything, what is this CL observed square. Okay, so it's 1 over 2L plus 1 square. So it's 1 over 2L plus 1 square, and then the average starts here, and it continues here. And then you have sum over m and sum over m prime from your definition, and then you have ALM star, and then ALM prime, ALM prime star. Just expanding. Okay, so this is stupid. Sorry for that. So it's times. Thing here. Everybody happy so far? Okay, so now we have four-point correlation function. So we use Wick's theorem. So we use so this will expand into three terms, right? So I'll have contraction like this and contraction like that. That's the first term, and then you have other terms. Okay, so this is minus 1 over CL square 2L plus 1 square. Okay, so now if I do the first contraction, first and second, it's delta LL, delta MM. So it's delta MM. Delta LL doesn't really do anything, so I'll just write these delta with respect to M. And there's the sum over MMN prime. Sum over MM prime is delta MM. Delta m prime, okay, so that's the first term. And the second term, so I will take this guy, is that guy. So now you may be thinking, okay, so that's like an annihilation and an annihilation operator, they have nothing to do. But actually you can show that because the expansion in temperature has to be real, then you know that this complex thing, so ALM star, is related to the non-complex by the following formula. It's minus 1 to M AL minus M. Okay, so this comes from the reality condition that those things actually are real. Okay? So now what it means is that if I'm contracting this guy with that guy, I will have delta M, I'll have minus 1 to m, and then I'll have delta m, and then minus m prime. But of course, minus m prime, m prime goes from minus l to l, so minus m prime is something like m prime, doesn't matter, okay, because you have both of them there. So then the second term is just delta m and then mm prime, and the third one is delta m and m prime, and there's minus 1 to 2m if you want. So that's the second term. And finally, the last term is that you are taking this guy with that guy, so it's delta m m prime plus delta m m prime and delta m m prime again. Okay, and then I forgot, of course, CL square. So I was just writing. So I omitted those guys. I was just writing those guys, and I still have to write CL square. So CL square is still here. Very good. So now we have the results. So we, so of course, delta mm and delta m prime, well, it doesn't do really much. So you have really both sums contributing. So this thing gives you 2L plus 1 square after the sum. So now these guys, this is delta m prime square. Well, this is just 1. So that kills one of the sums. And so, so that gives 2L plus 1. 2L plus 1 after the sum. And this is the same thing. So 2L plus 1. OK, so now happy result. We have this is minus 1, and CL square cancels, and then you have plus 1 over 2L plus 1 square, and then 2L plus 1 square plus 2 times 2L plus 1. And if you calculate what this is, and hopefully it is, then you get something like 2 over 2L plus 1. Okay? So in other words, of course, people are usually interested in the square root of this. So this is like delta of CL. And that goes like square root of 1 over L, if you want. So delta CL over CL square root of that goes like 2 over 2L plus 1 square root. So how much the CL is actually changing due to this distribution, if you want, goes like 1 over 2L. So bigger L, actually, of course, this is not a problem. But small, for small L, this can be huge. And this is exactly the origin of the errors which you have in your graph for CL. So this is your CL. So for small L, you have these huge error bars, which is precisely this cosmic variance. Okay. And as you go to higher and higher L, of course, this is less and less severe, and people don't care about those, right? Okay, and I told you that really, you know, close to the origin of quantum gravity predicts some changes of CL, but unfortunately, it's always in this cosmic variance, so it's not really a very useful prediction. Okay, unfortunately. So if you can predict something from quantum gravity, from your theory of quantum gravity, which is for larger L, that would be much better. Okay. Very good. Are there any questions to this? So this should explain really how you do this statistical thing on one ensemble. And of course, you know, your theory should give you what these CLs are. Okay, so once you specify what these CLs are, yeah?
Isn't the like 1 over root 2L plus 1 what you would just expect like before even calculating anything?
In some sense, yes. Yeah, you're right. So it's something
that's the number of values that's contributing to like the value you're
calculating. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. All right. I agree, yeah. Something like that, exactly like statistics on n.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the second thing which I didn't tell you about, well, I only told you briefly, is that of course the temperature is not the only thing you can measure about your photons, but of course photons are also polarized. So polarization of CMB And that's an initial information hiding in the CMB. And so you know that when you released your CMB, there was lots of this various scattering. And so this scattering actually produces polarized photons. So really, CMB is polarized. And this polarization may change a little bit after the photons pass through some medium in the galaxies and stuff like that. But you know, in average, it's given by what happened when the CMB was released. So anyway, so this is described. So in the same way as we had the distribution function f, which gave us the number of particles at a given phase space. So now, if you want to describe polarization, then you actually have to have a tensor, which is a symmetric tensor. It's a distribution function. And if you have a polarization, given by my vector EI, of course, that has to be normalized. So EI, EJ, delta IJ is just one. And you also know that photons, actually, the polarization of is like transverse wave. So EI, PJ, EI is equal to zero. So if you have momentum of your photon, then the polarization is perpendicular to it. And so once you have this distribution function, then you may be asking, you know, so with a given polarization E, we measure that number of photons in the phase space of Q and P. And that's given by Fi, J, Ei, Ej, D3x, D3p, 2 pi, U. OK, so it's precisely what you had before regarding the distribution functions. But now my distribution function is actually a tensor, and it carries the information that you can extract from it, you know, how many photons are polarized like that, and how many photons are polarized like that. Okay. Of course, what you measure is Fi, Q is on the airs, and P is the photons coming to you. Yes?
So we don't assume that the polarization is thermal somehow.
Is?
Thermal.
Yeah. Why would, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
But we assume that the power is thermal, right?
We assume that the powers are Gaussian, or?
No, when we were not looking at the polarization, we assumed that the CMB was thermal. Is it, or how exactly is it thermal?
Well, we had this approximation for the distribution function, but...
Yeah, but then we had already assigned to a temperature to it, so we already assumed that it was thermal.
Well, you didn't assume that. You derived that, right? Or you measured that.
Yeah.
But he is all, yeah. So in general, you know, it's any distribution function, which is now a tensor, and of course, you know, there are some constraints on what this distribution function has to be, and you can make some approximations, as we did, for example, that is described by this local thermal equilibrium, if you want. Yeah. Okay. So now, there is some powerful method how to deal with these tensors, and that's called SVT decomposition. And it's behind all perturbation theory in cosmology. So it's basically trivial, but it's not so trivial. So let me explain what it is. So there is something which is called SVT decomposition. So scalar vector tensor decomposition of a tensor. And so there's a theorem, mathematical theorem, is that any symmetric tensor in the dimensions can be decomposed. And so now we have the following. So you take the tensor Tij, and that can be written as a baseless transverse part. So it can be written as Hij transverse and traceless, and then some symmetrized product of a vector which is transverse, and then some scalars. Nabla I, nabla j of phi, and then minus 1/2 gij nabla square of phi, and then also some trace part, which is 1 over d psi gij. Okay, so the statement is, so if you calculate how many components a symmetric tensor Tij has in d dimensions, then you decompose it into components of H, components of a vector, and two scalars, phi and psi. Okay, and of course this should give the right number of components. So there are some conditions on what these guys are. And so transverse traceless. So traceless of course means that Gij, Hij, Tt. So if I calculate the trace, it's given it's zero. And transverse means that if you take the divergence of that, so nabla I, Hij, Dt is equal to zero as well. Okay, so it's like a Lorentz condition if you want impose on this Hij. People use this when they study gravitational waves as well. So anyway, okay. And so here the vector is also transverse, meaning that nabla I Vi transverse is equal to zero. So this is a theorem how you can decompose any symmetric tensor. So now this is true in d dimensions, but specifically if you have two dimensions, so why we are interested in two dimensions, because we know that there are only two polarizations of the photon. So if you are in two dimensions, if you want, if you are on a sphere, then you can show that Hij Tt actually has to be equal to zero. So there is no the first part. And the second part, you know that in two dimensions, the vector actually can be written as a derivative of a scalar, if you want. So then you can write Vi to be epsilon ij dj of some new scalar chi. Okay? So this is Vi t. So in two dimensions, because this part is identically equal to zero, this part is so this is my epsilon in two dimensions, it's just a Levitch-Witas tensor in two dimensions. And it can be written as a derivative of a scalar. So there's only one guy here. Of course, it must be only one guy, because vector has two components. But I'm killing one component by this condition. So this is the corresponding scalar, if you want. OK, so that means there's only three scalars, which is chi, phi, and psi. And so now the psi thing is basically like a trace part, and it can be shown that this is precisely what we already discussed. So the psi, the trace part of your decomposition. So we will want to apply this decomposition to our Fij. Okay. So now the psi part of that is related to the temperature, as we already discussed. So that's not actually an interesting part. And if you want to discuss the polarization, it is encoded in these two scalars, chi and phi. So this is polarization. So our Fij or our tensor Tij before I specify to that. So Tij in two dimensions can just be written as epsilon, whatever that formula for the scale is, I, and then K, nabla J symmetrized, nabla K chi. So that's the first thing. You have one derivative acting on V, and then you have this thing here, and then plus the phi part, nabla I, nabla J, minus 1/2 Gij, nabla square, acting on phi. And so that's the part which is actually describing your polarization. Okay. So now you define, you generalize your spheroidal harmonics, epsilon Ln, YLm, to the case when you have these extra components. And you take them to be precisely the operator, this operator 1, and there is an operator 2, which acts on your YLm. So you define tensorial spherical harmonic by, so we have I and J, because you want to expand the tensor, and then of course L and M. And depending on which operator is acting on your scalar function, you call it either E mode or B mode. That's the terminology. So the E mode is defined by the second operator. So there is some prefactor, which is 2 times L minus 2 factorial, L plus 2 factorial, which is not that important for us. But then this operator, nabla I, nabla j, minus 1/2 Gij, nabla square, and acting on my normal spherical harmonic. So this is the E mode. And then similarly you define a B mode, which is the other operator. Epsilon ij, B, L and M of N. And again, there's some prefactor, 1 over 2 minus 2 factorial, L plus 2 factorial, square root of that, and this operator here. So it's epsilon I k nabla j nabla k, and then plus that thing there. So it's epsilon j k nabla I nabla k acting on YLm. Okay, so that's the other part, and you call that B mode. Okay, so that's just definition of tensorial harmonics, and so now you can apply all this theory to really your polarization thing. And so these tensorial harmonics, they sort of behave similarly as normal spherical harmonics do. So they again are orthogonal, they are, you know, normalized and stuff like that. Okay, and if you take, of course, y e y b product, then you get 0, and you get y b gives you 1, y e gives you 1, and so on. Okay, so then you can decompose your distribution functions into sum over L and M, and then again, as we did, y l m, but now we call it e. And then y, l, m, I, j, l, and m. And then similarly, you will have some other a, l, m's which correspond to b, y, I, j, l, m, and then b. And then you would have this trace bar, which is like g, I, j, and then y, I, j, and d. Okay. regarding the polarization, this is it. And again, you can introduce the correlation functions between various. So again, you measure these guys if you want. This is just your basis, and you measure these guys, and you measure those guys. And you can do the same thing as we did over there. So you can introduce some CLs, which give your two-point correlation function for given polarization. Okay, so for example, you would have a LM, a L prime, M prime, star, let's say T, okay, B and E, and this will be just delta L, L prime, delta M, M prime, and then C, L, and then you remember that one is coming from B and one is coming from E, so you would call it CLBE. Okay, and then you would similarly do other correlation functions, and that would define these CLs for various cross terms, if you want. So now, regarding the notation, so the previous CLs, which are for the temperature, are sometimes called CLTT. Okay, so T like temperature, so people would put here, sometimes if they talk about polarizations as well, and various CLs, they would put TT here, because it's a temperature ALM and temperature ALM correlation function. So anyway, so now we have, it seems that you have lots of possibilities. You have, you know, various options. You can have, in principle, CLTE, CLTB, and so on. But actually, you can show that by some, again, symmetry constraints, most of these things actually vanish. And so really what is non-trivial, for example, so regarding B mode, which is actually an interesting mode, and I will tell you why in a minute, is that you can show that CLTB is equal to 0 and CLEB is equal to 0. So the only non-trivial CLs, and this is by symmetry, so the only non-trivial CLs is really CLBB. CLBB, only non-trivial B regarding the B mode, okay, polarization. Okay, so this is good. So now why I am telling you all this is because these B modes, and precisely actually CLBB, attracted lots of attention 2 years ago. And so similarly to CLTT, which we had the spectrum as we know it, you can try to plot the CLBB spectrum. And maybe I don't need even this. Of CLEB spectrum. And so if you plot it, CLEB, and this is my L, what you get is pretty much boring. You get something like this, and you'll see the exact picture. But the problem is, so what you are really describing here is, you know, one certain polarization of the photons coming to you. Okay? And so the source of this polarization is pretty much limited, actually. And in some sense, there are only two sources of this power spectrum. And the first source is gravity waves. Which actually come from the early universe, so basically produced by inflation. And the second source is gravitational lensing. And actually, at least these are the two sources people thought there are. But in fact, there is one more source of this. And that's actually if you have plasma in your galaxies, which contains lots of this, you know, magnetized plasma. So that can actually distort your polarization of photons as well. So there's actually also a source, if you want, which is like magnetized dust. In galaxies. So anyway, so what was the prediction is that if you didn't have this source, and people thought, you know, really this cannot have a big effect on your polarization of photons because there shouldn't be, you know, too much magnetic field in some sense which would distort your polarization. Okay, so people thought this is sort of negligible. So then you have these two sources. And so the gravitational lensing sort of affects the spectrum over here. So that's the lensing part. And then if you had gravitational waves, they should produce some very, very specific form. They should cause this bump here. So this should be gravity waves. Okay. So now, of course, comes a famous measurement by SEP2 in 2014, and they precisely, you know, they wanted to measure this PB mode of a spectrum, and they precisely measured this guy here. Okay, so then there was this big, you know, excitement that really people thought, well, this is a discovery of gravity waves. And it's a discovery of the fact, well, we had inflation, and it's the first measurement of gravity waves ever, and they come from the early universe. Okay, so discovery of gravity waves, if you want. And in fact, what they also predicted, or what they measured, is the ratio, which we will calculate later on in the course, is the tensorial mode versus the scalar mode, which you produce like fluctuation, how big the fluctuations are with respect to tensors, gravity, with respect to scalar. Okay, and they calculated this to be, well, they measured that to be 0.2, which actually was a great prediction because many other people think that it has to be zero approximately. Okay, and so they claim to measure it's 0.2, and that actually ruled out thousands and thousands, thousands and thousands of theories at this point. Okay, so this was really, really strong discovery, but of course, unfortunately, this was not true at all. And so what they really underestimated is the third source of this BB mode. And so they taken some data from unfinished experiment, but they claim, well, really the magnetized dust doesn't really contribute. But actually, it contributes and it causes precisely this. So actually, it's not gravity waves as they measured, but it's rather the magnetized dust. So all these predictions actually went away when they were confronted with the Planck data. So could I get the screen, please? So just to show you the real data, so there was this huge hello, which unfortunately went away. And actually, Neil was one of the first persons actually to say, no, this looks very suspicious and probably not correct. Of course, he has his motivations because his bad theory of the early universe actually predicts that R is equal to zero. So if you know this measurement was true, then it would be ruled out. So Neil had his motivation, but anyway, he correctly predicted that. Thank you. So let's see if that connects. And maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. Function. Was it? And it doesn't again. Okay.
There's something.
There's something?
There was something.
No?
It doesn't look like it's connecting at 9 now.
Okay, I'll try again. You know, I just want to show you this data. But if it doesn't show one, that's fine. Let me try it once more. Now? No?
Yeah.
Yeah? Something is showing up and disappearing again. try once more. Okay. Anyway, so okay, it's not important. So what I really wanted to show you is exactly this measurement here of the CLBB, and really how nicely they had this data, which looked like really they were looking for gravity waves and they discovered them as precisely as they expected, but unfortunately it's not true. So I wanted to show you that. I wanted, of course, the measurement happens in the South Pole. So there's this, you know, if you are excited about cold weather, you can go there, and there's this, you know, these telescopes basically measuring these things. And so now there's various versions of this. There was BICEP 1 and now BICEP 2, and there's something better even now, started 2016. So you can go there in the South Pole. Anyway, so let me stop here.